The typical Christopher Nolan movie takes place on a very stylish Mobius strip. Time shifts this way and that. Heroes morph into anti-heroes. Nolan's movies can be challenging. You may have to watch them twice just to get them. Like the fantastic told-in-reverse whodunit Memento, or the dream-within-dream heist story Inception. And then there's his Batman movies.
You don't owe these people anymore. You've given them everything.
Not everything. Not yet.
Nolan's slick, noirish reboots are as close to cinematic art as the superhero movie gets. His latest film is Interstellar, starring Matthew McConaughey, Jessica Chastain, and Anne Hathaway. As our near-future Earth turns into a doomed dust bowl, a handful of space explorers heads off to find a new home.
This world's a treasure. It's been telling us to leave for a while now.
Your daughter's generation will be the last to survive on Earth.
Christopher Nolan, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So movies about space travel come with a big burden of the past. One thinks of 2001, Star Wars, Houston, We Have a Problem. As you were conceiving of this film, did you think, there are certain tropes I have to avoid or embrace, or how did that work?
Well, somebody I was talking to about the film put it very politely in that they said the film is in conversation with 2001. Which I took to be a polite version of ripping it off. But I think the way I had put it is I can't make Interstellar as if 2001 didn't exist. I live in a world where it exists, and that's my chief inspiration for making the film. So I really tried to simply be inspired by it and try, hopefully, and add something.
But no apes or Johann Strauss.
No Strauss, no apes, exactly. But not in front of the camera anyway.
It is different from many of your previous films in being so grounded in human relationships and the peculiar bonds and conflicts within families. Did you begin with it, seeing it that way?
I always saw it that way. The thing that drew me to the project was this combination or contrast between a very intimate story of a father and his children and that relationship and how it's tested, and the cosmic scale of the test of that relationship. In this case, man leaving the Earth to live somewhere else, you know, moving, finding our place in the universe. Seeing that by looking over the shoulder of a relatable protagonist, a family, that seemed really, really fascinating to me.
And were you ready to do that somehow at 40 in a way that didn't interest you at 30?
I think I was. I mean, I think being a father myself was the reason I really gravitated towards the material.
Of four children.
And my eldest child is a daughter, and Cooper, Matthew McConaughey's character in Interstellar, the relationship with his daughter is a very important thing in the film. And I think as I get older and as I make more films, I find that it's the emotional connection with the stories that keeps me obsessively interested in the project.
Interstellar is set in the future. We don't know when exactly, enough so that space travel through a wormhole is possible. But its vision of the future on Earth is very early 21st century. Nothing is very different.
From a design point of view, myself and my designer, Nathan Crowley, we decided early on that we didn't want the appearance of things to be guessed at in terms of how will people's trousers look in the future, how will their hairstyles be, what will a truck look like in the future. We're asking so much of the audience in terms of absorbing a set of ideas, going on a big journey. I wanted everything to be relatable.
You don't, I read, have an email address or a smartphone. You prefer shooting on location when possible rather than in a green screen. You would like to have effects in the camera rather than spend all your time on post-production. Are you ambivalent or even more resistant to the digital revolution?
I don't regret the transition. I deny that it's even taken place. No, I live in massive
denial. I believe you're wrong about that.
I live in massive denial. No, I shoot on film because it's technically the best medium. And so I carry on working that way until something better comes along. For me, there's a theme in the film that really is saying, look, we've had all kinds of technological advancements over the last couple of decades that have been very much to do with what's in our pockets, what's in the corner of our living rooms, how we communicate. I think it would be interesting to see that turn outwards again now. And, you know, when I was a kid, people were looking off the planet. They were looking, okay, how can we use technology to explore our place in the universe? I think one of the themes of Interstellar is maybe we should get back to that. Wouldn't that be exciting?
And you had a famous physicist as your technical advisor. Hmm. Did push come to shove sometimes where you said, no, I want to do this? And he said, you're the movie maker. Go ahead. This isn't true, but go ahead.
No, he never did that.
This is Kip Thorne.
Kip Thorne, wonderful guy to work with. And he tried to offer me the possibilities of real science, which are far more mind-bending than anything you come up with as a screenwriter. The only one that Kip really put his foot down and said, look, you can't do that, is I had wanted to have an element of the story where a spaceship would travel faster than the speed of light. And he just said,
that's the ultimate no-go.
He's like, it took about 2 weeks of arguing about it. It's like, I'll have to take your word for it,
Kip. You were 28 when you made your first feature, which was called Following, which is about a young man who stalks strangers for fun and then meets a guy who shows him how to break into houses. I want to play a clip of that.
Nothing here of any value.
I don't seem that concerned.
I don't do it for the money.
Why do you do it?
For the adrenaline. And because, like you, I'm interested in people. Now, you can tell a lot about people from their stuff.
That is Jeremy Theobald and Alex Haw in Following. The story is not linear. Really, two different timelines are cut together, which is something that we see in your films, many of them anyway, since Memento, Inception, Interstellar, even. All of them, in some sense, they explore either the subjectivity of time, the fungibility of its direction, and all those things. Why is that so interesting to you?
I think part of what's going on is I'm the first of a generation who grew up with home video, and you're making films that are going to be watched more than once by definition because you're going to sell them on home video. You're going to show them on cable TV. People are going to watch them in a different way. They're going to have a different relationship to that narrative. And so it's exciting to take advantage of that.
That's interesting. And I'd never thought of the part that home video had in that. And you make films that require at least two viewings to understand.
I mean, I have years to make these films and you've only got 2.5 hours, 3 hours to watch it in. So I feel a burden to be putting layers in there, to be putting things that could enhance a second or a third viewing, if you're interested. Obviously, the initial experience has to be that first viewing has to be everything. Otherwise, you won't bother to take a closer look.
Memento was when you came on my radar screen and I saw it. I thought it was an amazing movie. It was a breakthrough for you. It's about a man with no long-term memory who is trying to hunt down his wife's killer.
Are you sure you want this?
Have I told you what this man did?
Yeah.
Well, then you shouldn't have to ask.
But even if you get revenge, you're not going to remember it. You're not even going to know that it happened.
My wife deserves vengeance. Doesn't make any difference whether I know about it. Just because there are things I don't remember doesn't make my actions meaningless. The world doesn't just disappear when you close your eyes, does it? Anyway, maybe I'll take a photograph to remind myself.
That was Guy Pearce and Carrie Ann Moss in Memento, which I discovered started out as a short story by your brother, Jonathan Nolan. How did it become a movie?
We were taking a road trip together. We were driving from Chicago to Los Angeles when I first moved to Los Angeles in the late 90s, having just finished Following. And Jonah told me that he was working on a story, and he just sort of told it to me verbally. And I got very excited about it. Immediately sort of said to him, do you mind if I take that, what you've given me, just explaining it to me and write a screenplay from it while you finish a short story?
So you're like one of these predatory producers getting to novels before they're even published.
Well, completely. I had special access because it was my brother, and he, you know, I did warn him at the time. It's like, you know, until you finish with something, keep it close.
Memento is not the only one of your films that is so complicated that it is challenging. Yes, people can watch it again and again on video to get a clearer sense of it. But at the time, were you surprised, given how challenging it is, that this was a commercial success?
Not really. I mean, it was more a question of when you're starting out, you don't know what to be afraid of, and that gives you great courage. But originally, when I set out to do it, I saw it as a very accessible film.
Really?
What I found with my films is people who just sort of sit back and relax and try to enjoy them as a ride, they understand them much better than people who go in sort of, you know, approaching them like there's some kind of crossword puzzle to be solved.
But they sort of invite the crossword puzzle approach, don't they?
I don't know. I encourage people to try and enjoy them as an entertainment first and foremost.
When you pitched the rebooting Batman to Warner Brothers in 2003, you had made three successful movies. You'd shown that you could handle a big budget, but you were not. Oh, Christopher Nolan. Yes, of course. Batman. You got that gig after pitching them for 90 minutes? I've never heard of a 90-minute pitch. What did you tell them?
I don't know, but it must have been good because they signed up. No, I what I told them was, look, they took a hell of a leap of faith. But I think that what they felt from me was a very sincere desire to say, okay, I grew up watching, you know, Dick Donner's Superman, the epic treatment for a superhero. So he's an extraordinary figure in an ordinary world. And what happened with Batman is that film never got made. What got made was Tim Burton's incredible and wonderful and idiosyncratic, you know, could only be Tim Burton yes. take on the character that was so influential and extraordinary, but sort of sidestepped that kind of more conventional, epic, sort of, okay, let's take an ordinary world and let's put this extraordinary figure in it. And suddenly I found myself going, oh, I know what I would do with it because I know the version of it that I never got to see.
Right. When I saw Batman Begins in 2005, I thought, as I said on this program, it was the best superhero movie I'd ever seen. And then 3 years later, the sequel, The Dark Knight, became the best superhero movie I'd ever seen, and I guess probably still is. I want to play a clip from that. This is where Batman, for the first time, is face-to-face with his nemesis, the Joker.
I don't want to kill you. What would I do without you? Go back to ripping off mob dealers? No, you complete me.
You're garbage. You kills for money.
Don't talk like one of them. You're not. Even if you'd like to be.
That was Christian Bale as Batman and Heath Ledger as the Joker. Heath Ledger had just won an Oscar for Brokeback Mountain, which didn't make him an obvious choice to play the great villain of our time. Why did you cast him?
I cast him because I'd met him a couple of times over the years for different parts and nothing had really panned out. I admired his work as an actor tremendously, but it really was this thing of just sitting down and seeing in somebody's eyes that they were ready to really show the world something. And when you look at an actor's eyes like that and you see that they're ready and that they're going to bring something to it that's very, very special, you don't worry about, you know, what people are going to think, what they've done before, what they haven't done before. Uh-huh. You just know it. You see it and you go with that.
And he won the Academy Award posthumously for the role. Did you and he sort of figure out the particular mannerisms together, the phlegmy kind of speech and things? Or how did that happen?
Well, there were some things we talked about. We tried to use the hair and makeup wardrobe tests as a bit of a test bed. You know, we'd get a handheld camera. And my DP, Wally Fisher.
And he'd do some lines, yeah?
He'd do some lines, but we weren't recording sound.
Uh-huh.
So he was very free. You know, I think that freed him up, that we weren't saying, okay, how does the Joker laugh? Okay, tell us what he does. He was just gradually showing me things that I felt that he'd been working on for many months, truthfully. And on the makeup front, we collaborated with his makeup artist. I brought in paintings of Francis Bacon and sort of said,
that's
something
interesting.
In these colors. There's a feeling of that. Yeah. And one of the things Heath wanted to do first, which is incredibly logical, of course, it completely escaped me, is to try applying the makeup himself. Because obviously, the character would actually have to do that. And,
yeah.
And one of the wonderful things that came out of that was he always had sort of crusty sort of makeup on his fingers and, you know, under his nails and things, which it was just a lovely touch.
That's interesting because people talk about, oh, we never have enough time to rehearse movies. This is a different kind of pre-rehearsal, conceptual rehearsal that you did, it sounds like.
I've found that every actor wants a different thing out of rehearsal. And I think a lot of them, and Heath was certainly like this, they like to sneak up on it. They don't want to be put on the spot and have a bunch of, you know, producers and myself and executives sitting there going, okay, what is it? give us what it is.
Yeah.
And so you'll read a scene, just him and Christian, you'll just talk about it, whatever, and then you'll hear a little bit of a voice coming through, a little bit of a laugh, you know, he's been working on. Watching it develop was a really exciting thing.
Even though you don't want me to look at your movies as crossword puzzles that I'm trying to figure out, I have noticed that in every one, I believe every one, the male lead's wife or girlfriend either is already dead or gonna die. Why is that?
No spoilers, please. Why is that? It's because I work in melodrama. You know, I love film noir. I love crime novels. I love the universality that you are granted by stepping a little further away from conventional drama. And so things like the quest for revenge, you know, or the haunted nature of a protagonist, these are the staples of those forms of melodrama.
But you also you have a clear, rigorous sense of, I don't want to go over this line of reality to cartooniness.
Yeah. When I talk about melodrama, when I talk about heightened reality, I'm really talking about the narrative, the story elements. Uh-huh. As far as tone goes, I think as a filmmaker, I get the most out of trying to adopt as rigorously realistic a tone as possible. And however much you try that, you're still dealing in a theatrical medium. And so the films of today, in 20 years' time, they will look heightened. You know, the artifice will be more apparent.
This will be a Baroque period?
Yeah, well, this is true of my work as anybody else's.
Yeah.
But the attempt is to really try and give a feeling of texture, a feeling of reality, because my feeling is the combination of heightened dramatic elements, really extreme story elements, with a believable texture, that, for me, provides the most exciting entertainment.
Christopher Nolan, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christopher Nolan's latest movie, Interstellar, has just opened in theaters all over America. We actually talked for the better part of an hour, and if you'd like to hear our whole conversation, you may do so at studio360.org.